Okay, we're on as far as the recording. Thank you very much, Ms. Smith. Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone, to our afternoon discussion session. It's April the 8th, 1 p.m. This is being audio recorded. Would remind you that we have a lot, even though we have several things that are on the agenda already, we have a lot of things that that we can add at any time or delete at any time, depending on what the circumstances are. Dr. Adams, what would, if I may at this time, what would, you had two items that you
I do have a couple of items. One is we want to clarify some information that has been requested on the bid for the administration complex. So Mr. Morrison and Mr. Chumar will come down later.
Okay.
Also, the board revisions, that policy revisions that we talked about regarding contractors and employees. And Mr. Fritz will come down later as well to talk about the rationale for the job descriptions being in the agenda and HR reorg. So this is all my information for about 3 o'clock or sooner.
And just to clarify, we also, following this, we do have an executive session. Okay. All right. Let's get started. Ms. Disney?
Thank you. The first item I had is the title of class size, and I was the one who said class size, but probably should have been entitled school choice, because one of the things I've been learning about many districts in the state is that because the requirements for school for class size are different, depending on the model of school choice that you follow, there are school districts using school choice as a way to do school size averaging rather than class size averaging. And because we have such a variety of school choice already in our county, I'm interested in having a conversation about being a choice county and what that would mean to us. What I think we need to find out what all of us think choice means when it comes to transportation and other mm-hmm. things. And we also need to have in front of us the black and white stuff, what the implementation mm-hmm. requires to have school size averaging rather than class size.
Could I ask a question?
Yeah.
One is, basically what I'm hearing from the legislation is right now is we may be having the opportunity to go to class size average. There was some discussion in the legislature with regard to the penalty. In other words, you're still held to the class size, but with regard to the penalty, they may be looking at changing it to the average rather than this. So that's one piece of information that's out there. And second of all, I know there are a couple of counties that have done this, so I would be interested in knowing who they are. I know Duval was going to, and they pulled back.
Mm-hmm.
But if, can you give me any, and I'd like to follow up with them so I
okay.
can get some, gather some information.
Well, and again, that's why I said it probably should have been called school choice rather than class size, because
yeah.
they're not, I don't think that the goal is to avoid the class size.
Right.
Either the penalty or the requirement. I think the goal is to have more flexibility in the district. And flexibility is something we sorely need with the amount of mandates that we have. But we are all unique counties, and our, one of the things about us is the geographical layout of our population and our schools. Mm-hmm. So we have to look at that to see if that is actually something that will work for our county and not cost us more rather than less to implement.
Right. So Duval was one.
I have to go
I'll find out, too.
Yeah.
Lee.
Okay.
Yeah.
School district implemented a district-wide choice
yeah.
program.
Okay. I'll bring back some information.
Thank you. Any other board comments on this issue? Yes, Ms.
I just have a question. I mean, you did say it'd be interesting to hear what we think the definition of choice is. When you're talking about having a district that's a district of choice, does that mean that every single school is a school of choice? So you don't have any zoning anymore for particular neighborhood schools, but every school is a selected school by a family? Is that what Duval and Lee County are doing?
Well, that's what I'm not sure about, if they're using zone choice or if they're using free choice. I think when you're providing transportation, zone choice is something that's more realistic, because you can't have buses going from the northwest corner to the southeast corner. But in zone choice, you can have hubs for transportation so that you don't have as many stops and you don't have as, you know, an increase the cost of transportation. In fact, there are some schools that feel like it decreases the cost of transportation. Mm-hmm.
So there must be some different models.
Okay, and I need to ask, we have audience that's leaning forward because they can't hear. Please bring your microphones close. We are only audio recorded, so please project or however you can handle it.
Use your phys ed voice.
There you go. So is this something we want to pursue as for information? I mean, this is designating some time that we need to have. So if we don't have people who are interested, you know, we've had these things before, great ideas and wonderful opportunities for more information, but you know, do we want some staff time spent on this?
Thank you. Sure, I would, because I would like to understand this more, have other examples from other counties to see how they're doing it, but I want to make sure I'm understanding before we task, because it is a lot of hours that you'll put into it, even just calls. First thing I get a lot of questions on, I don't want my child to go to school A, no way. I call the district, they tell me, no way, I can't out of district. They're telling me I can't. At least that's what they're thinking. Mm-hmm. So when you say, if I'm understanding you, you're saying school choice, that it's a developmental theory, but you're looking to have a choice where someone from, let's say, Sebastian can go down to Oslo Middle School. Or when you say hubs, I'm not really sure, and I know we still have to get more information, but so you're looking at school choice would be that a family could choose any school in the district appropriate for their age and go to an alternate school?
Well, I'm not suggesting any particular model at all. What I'm saying is that there are choice models that give you some more flexibility in the class size amendment. Mm-hmm. And so I'd first like to know what those models are. I don't know what those models are. I don't know if they mean total district, any free-for-all, or if there's a definition of it. So I'm interested in learning more about that, but I'm also interested in learning how my fellow board members feel about our families having more choice, because we are faced with the competition now of vouchers for ESE, for low income, for homeschoolers. I mean, we're faced with so many vouchers. We're faced with the competition of our charter school. And I say that it is not that we don't have as good or better as any of the other choices out there. It's that sometimes parents are zoned for a school that may not necessarily be the one that they would choose for themselves. And I think that maybe we shoot ourselves in the foot if we are rigidly defining zones for schools when we could keep a student under our roofs if we had more flexibility. We're faced with a lot of competition out there. We have the seats in many of our schools. We do have the problem of class size amendment, which means we have to have limited choice because you can't let everybody choose what school, or you would not be able to have enough classrooms in some of our campuses. But I think that it's time that we really look at that and use choice as one of the models that we use for our parents to have some say in their education, because the paradigm has so shifted that that's one of the reasons I think that parents are taking their kids and going to another system, another model of education, because we don't offer as much choice as they'd like to have.
And in these counties where we have this choice model type system, what happens to magnet schools?
Well, magnet schools are one of our choices.
Okay, we still have audience that cannot hear. So if you please, they're trying to hear. If you'd ask your question again, please.
I asked what happens to magnet schools in this model.
Magnet schools are one of our choices, and from what I understand in the class size amendment, that if you have choice, then your magnet schools also become school size average rather than class size average, once you have more choice in other areas.
We actually have looked at that some of the language is not, you know, we need to dig further into that. And I think along with that, we can talk about what we currently have and don't have. You know, because I want to respond to the fact that, you know, Mrs. Simchek says she gets calls and parents say, well, you don't have a choice. Well, in some instances you don't, because the school doesn't have space. And the other perception out there is that there's a lot of space, which there's not, because we closed a school. We have 50 fewer spaces than we had a few years ago because we closed a school. That radically changed how our schools, you know, the population of the schools as well. So I think it's good to have that choice discussion, bring about, we're talking about what our choices are, what parameters we're currently under, what that could expand to. It certainly is something that would take time because it's a paradigm shift from, you know, how you're doing it now. And I'm most familiar with the discussion of a choice school district, of everybody having a choice. That means that, yes, in fact, transportation has to be worked out and you have to figure all that in. But if you wanted to go to a different middle school and you have an open choice, that's what that would mean. Okay, so, you know, there aren't a lot of counties that are doing it right now, but there's a lot of discussion about it because of the idea of choice. And people want
So, just to repeat, I would be interested in some more information, but I really wouldn't want to task staff in an in-depth study. Just if, since we're not really sure what we want or what we're gearing towards, because we don't know, a nice general, I would be in favor of a general start a conversation for a little more facts and information. I'm obviously open-minded about this. But I, again, with budget and all these things coming up, I wouldn't want to say, yeah, let's go bring us the full Monty and then a lot of time and then it's shelved because we get to one aspect of it that we didn't get early on that totally violates any of our thinking. And so I think that I would be in favor of a more information.
Does any board member feel as though this is enough of an emergency to have information prior to our next discussion session? Or is our next discussion session?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
That gives you a timeline, gives you some direction. And I'm sure Ms. DeAgress is going to have some comments about the legality of certain things. So thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Bisbee. Under my items, it says discussion executive sessions. I think we've already established that our executive sessions are going to be moved to the first board meeting of the month. That was the direction of the board, correct? Question mark?
That's what I understood.
Okay. All right. So I'm not going to use up my time with discussing that item again. I have lots of items here. And the first one's going to be, actually it's very timely. As many of you know, we did have a critic of the school district who last week and this week spoke to the county commission regarding the impact fees and made some very inappropriate and incorrect comments. We even had a commissioner who supported those comments and said that Thompson Elementary School was closed and is now a business enterprise for the school district on taxpayer-owned property for a three-bay car wash. And that commissioner stated very clearly that he'd been there and he'd seen it. So I don't know what we're doing with our Osceola kids. I thought they were going there every day. But I would like to discuss with the board the possibility of... we are not, or I'm not, as your chairman. Someone else can if it's the desire of the board. But as your chairman, I am not going to go speak to respond to incorrect information. Information had been given to this person back in September. They've got some additional information since then. Board members, you all received a copy of that information from September 11th. But I would like the board's comments and direction, if you so choose. I would be willing to write a letter to all of the commissioners individually, not just a blanket letter, but something to them specifically, individually, with copies of that email, with the correct information, with you know, the fact that Thompson Elementary is alive and well as the new home of Osceola Magnet. But as the chairman, I have no authority to do that independently. I need your comments, and I need your direction, at least three of you. Mr. McCain's saying do it. So, okay, I'm blocked. I'm seeing all four of you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. You, of course, will receive a copy of that once it's done. And Dr. Adams, I'll be getting with Mr. Morrison on some additional information before I write that letter. I don't want to make an assumption on something and my response be incorrect. So, and for your information, the impact fee study is being done by the county. It's not expected to be completed for at least another month. But we need to talk about what we know is being done with the impact fee money and why it isn't good for us, and the lack of capital funds, PICO funds, you know, have all gone to the charters. Was it 2 years in a row?
PICO?
For longer than that.
Longer than 2 years?
More than that.
Ms. Begrest, are you familiar with that?
I want to say it's 4 or 5 years that they've been.
That's a piece of information I want to put in the letter to them, so I need to know that.
Yeah,
Mr. Morrison, I know. But I just wanted to let you know, Dr. Adams, if that's okay. I'm going to contact him directly after this.
Mrs. Johnson, I also mentioned to the rest of the board members that Mr. Morrison and Mr. Sanders actually met with the consultant and Mr. Bowling. So they are proactively working, you know, with the consultant. So it's very preliminary for anybody to be discussing current impact fees and what we are or not getting.
Yes.
Which consultant?
The county.
Okay. Thank you.
No, we don't have a consultant.
Thank you.
We're giving
you
consultant. But we need to make certain that the appropriate information is out there, and we don't use the public venue to get into an argument. Yes, Ms. Jimenez.
And I just wanted to add, you know, when I've gone to the Economic Development Council when they were talking about impact fees, Mr. Morrison does an excellent job of keeping track of what the numbers are, how they're used, and you know, we are doing our due diligence, so I think this is really important to follow up, and I appreciate our chairman doing so.
Thank you. Generally, the chairman says we don't need to respond, but I feel as though we've had 2 weeks of someone having a bully pulpit with unlimited time, because you just stand up and start talking. This person has been on the agenda, however, for 2 weeks in a row, and that is all broadcast, and we need to get accurate information to the commissioners. That's what we need to be doing. Thank you very much. All right, Ms. Jimenez, what do you want to start with?
Well, I'd like to just go over the meeting dates and get that out of the way. We, at the last meeting, we changed the time for the board meeting in June to the 24th, which means that I will be able to attend, and the reason why we did that was because not doing so would have meant that two board members versus one board member would have been absent. So that's fine, but that still leaves me with conflicts, and I don't like to miss board meetings. I really make an effort because it is my responsibility as an elected official to attend, but I do have two conflicts. I have one coming up in May, which is a great conflict to have. My daughter is, who's a Vero Beach High School graduate, is graduating from college. So I will not be here, but I can attend that meeting. I can't attend the workshop, but I can attend the meeting via phone. I can call in. So I won't be here physically, but there will be a quorum, and I can attend by phone. But in October, I will be at another meeting, and I will not be able to call in. So I think that's far in advance enough that we don't plan workshops, or we can move the workshops, and no one's going to be highly inconvenienced. So looking at the calendar, the meetings for October are the 14th and 28th, and I'd like to ask my colleagues if there would be a willingness to make those meetings the 7th and the 21st.
Okay. We probably need to go back. I didn't bring my calendar with me because I didn't really want to talk about dates. But the meeting in June, the 24th, we changed to the 17th, just to remind you all. We moved it up to the 17th. Then we moved it back to the 24th because two board members were going to be out.
Right.
So the 24th is our regular meeting day, and we were hoping that it could be, at the time, we didn't realize what the conflict was going to be. So before we make a decision, I think today on the October, we probably need to check our calendars. And I do not have mine with me. I know, Mr. McCain, you're a Tuesday boy. Tuesday man.
So you're all Tuesdays, it would be from the 2nd, 4th, and 1st, and 3rd.
Right,
yes, we've done.
I don't think there's a problem, but let's just be sure. And then, is that something Dr. Adams can come out of your office and we can confirm?
Sure.
Okay. So please let Dr. Adams, Mr. McCain has said he's a go, Ms. Jimenez is a go, Ms. Simchick is a go, and I apologize,
you'll let us know.
It's fine with me, but I just wanted to add that since there's 5 Tuesdays in September, that makes that first the meeting on the first Tuesday a little easier for everybody because okay. we don't have to do back-to-back.
Okay, that's good. We have 5 weeks.
Yeah, that might be some of that.
Actually, that does work out better because we did move that November meeting. Didn't we move November?
Well, I wasn't looking at November, but I was looking at September. That worked well for September. And yes, we did move the November meeting up. So
that'll work out. Mm-hmm. Well, since you have four board members, one and Dr. Adams, you just clear your calendar.
Okay.
And then you send out something to us letting us know, because even if I do have a conflict, that's only one board member, so I don't have to be it. Okay. All right. Can I give you some names? Mr. McCain. Mm-hmm. Ms. Simchick.
Nothing.
Okay. Miss Disney?
Yes, the band scores. it's been something that all of us have been advocating for with Department of Education and with legislators. But, you know, the recent exposure, if you will, of the band scores have set our teachers kind of on a ledge. And so because of that, when I spoke to governor's staff, Kim McDougall, who was his education policy chief, but now she is his director of policy, she replied that when you see these extremes of band scores where you have really good teachers who are affected to the negative by them, and when you have teachers that previously were not quite as effective and are now rated highly effective, she said that is a... That there is intrinsically something in the model that can be adjusted that can help our teachers who are affected that way. So with that information, I just felt that was really important to report back to the board that if that is the case, that we can take another look at that model and make sure that we don't have these extremes for our teachers, that I think that it's incumbent upon us to do so, because even though the public does not understand and use the VAM information correctly, it's still affecting our teachers. However, and I think that we need to go as far as we can to correct that. So,
just so the board knows, we had staff had probably an hour discussion last week on questions, you know, kind of issues that we've had, and you know, get asking a lot of questions, and so some of those extremes, you know, mm-hmm. did come up, and so we've and they've acknowledged, you know, that they hadn't accounted for, you know, some of that. So we are giving our input to the state, to those that have influence over those people that we have no control over the formula itself, but we do have control over giving input and sharing what our own experiences are, and trying to get some answers on, you know, what are they doing to assist school districts with those kinds of problems. So we just recently had a over an hour conference with them. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, she did acknowledge that there are problems in mm-hmm. the system, and then all the kinks haven't been worked out, but that there were some things in school districts that we could do to ameliorate some of those extremes. So whether it's in the some of the choices we've made and how we implement the Marzano model, or whether, I don't know if there's anything that we've done in the choices we've made, but we need to make sure that we look at all those T's and I's. But
not when it comes to the VAM score itself. It's calculated based on FCAD mm-hmm. and the formula that they have. You know, they provide us the score. Now, once we get the score, then there are some other negotiations that have taken place in terms of how we, you know, look at those. But as far as the score itself, we really don't have a lot of control, but we have a lot of say in terms of giving input and sharing some of our experiences about.
Okay. Well, I hope you'll share your Don Quixote story and holler. Because, you know, when a school district and a school board supports evaluation based on student achievement, with that comes the responsibility to make sure that we're not shortchanging them in any way.
Okay, so what is that? Oh, yes.
No, I just have a comment, because, you know, whenever we talk about VAM scores, I always like us to remember that there is a lot of research that supports it and a lot of research that points out all of the weaknesses and issues with using VAM in general. And we're seeing part of that here in Florida in terms of the challenges faced just for our school district. And it's sad because nobody really understands. You know, we all bought into, really had no choice to buy into this formula that people don't even understand. When we adopted it, even our staff couldn't explain it. So it's not, as you know, any insult to anyone. It's just the reality of what happens when politics takes over in education. So I think that we do the best we can, but as Dr. Adams said, this formula is controlled by the state, and there, and it was designed by Floridians to our nuances, and it's all very subjective. It's not what's best for teachers, but that's what we have. And even today on our budget, on our agenda, we're seeing the last agreement that was made about VAM scores, and it's the best that we can do in order to make sure that teachers have an evaluation, because the VAM is really only for reading and math. So there's a lot of stuff beyond our control, and I'm hopeful we are able to work with our union and our teachers to do what's best for our teachers, given the constraints that we face.
And I would say one of the issues with the VAM right now is everybody's being assessed basically using the VAM, when in fact there are guidance counselors and others who, you know, they're not teaching FCAT math or reading or that type of thing. So that's going to change over time, because starting 14-15, other assessments have to be in place to evaluate those that don't fall under, will not get a VAM score. So it's ever changing, it's evolving, and there's still tremendous work to be done. And but
oh, absolutely.
Thank you. You know, I think what's getting under my skin is that it isn't the guidance counselors and the peripheral folks that are so affected. It's our in the classroom teachers that should be real black and white if they're effective teachers or not. It's some of those teachers that we're seeing the greatest impact to. So that's why it's really under my skin, is that you have polar opposite information that you're getting with using these scores. You have parents' feedback, student test scores, student comments, parent comments, principal evaluations, all saying this is a good classroom teacher, there's a lot of learning going on in here, and then you get a VAM score that says, not so much. You know, the VAM score affecting the teacher's evaluation. So that's what's really getting under my skin, is that where it should be black and white, it's not coming out right. So I would expect it to not come out right on the peripherals, on the guidance counselors and the media specialists. Those are the ones that should have the anomalies. Mm-hmm. But for an anomaly to be in a classroom is kind of bothering me.
You're going to get back to us with some information as to your considerations for.
You're just going to take your flag.
But as far as once we get the VAM scores, you don't have additional information that you're going to give us about some of the things you're
doing. No, I mean, where.
But isn't that negotiated?
The VAM score is not negotiated. And what you do after you get the VAM score and the combination of the two, you know, are negotiated.
Okay. I wasn't looking to give you more work. I was just looking.
This was a very much a
thank you very much.
Work in progress.
Excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry.
So I just want to make sure I'm hearing right, because obviously the VAM score with procedural, you know, as far as negotiated, how we will. What percentage the VAM will be versus whatever is negotiated.
Right.
Then I'm confused, because you said that Tallahassee told you that it must be something inherent in the model. So how could it be something inherently wrong in the model if the model's the model, you get the score? It's really, I don't think that's right then. I'm not sure. So maybe I would ask if you could respectfully maybe make another call and say what was her thought to that.
Well, what did you hear, Claudia, when Kim McDougall addressed that? Because what I heard her say was they recognize there's problems in the model, and they know that there's work to do, mm-hmm. But there are things that we can do in our county that will get rid of some of those extremes. That's what I heard her say.
And I was in the room too, but what I focused on, this is where all our biases come in.
Yeah.
So what I focused on was there is something inherently wrong with the model. That's beyond our control because that model was imposed on us. And so they need to be real about what they're imposing on our teachers. So there's my bias.
I wasn't in the room, but I'm taking that to mean that you can make it only 10% and use the rest on something else.
And I'm just making light of it. But I think I understand now what you're saying. But obviously it's stuff that's under negotiation, so we'll figure it out at that table.
But not to disregard that, you know, if you follow through on the hearing, like I didn't, and there is something that we can do locally, by all means, it would be worth a follow-up.
Yes, I will follow
so up. That we know, you know, there's something that we could do that's within our purview. Mm-hmm. By all means, let's do it.
And I would like her to follow up with me.
Okay, so...
Because I think she's maybe talking about school and district vans as opposed to, you know, classroom, but I would like to know that.
Yes, I would too.
So, Ms. Stang, we'll want to put the follow-up for the BAM scores on next month's discussion also. Thank you very much. Okay, my next item is we had talked about Dr. Adams' contract, which says that we will have an organizational chart by a certain time. We decided as a board that, you know, we're not going to put some of that out because it's not the most effective or efficient use of that document. And we do have some reorganization, which is fine because that's already been discussed with people in-house. But for some other things, we're going to wait on that. My question is, and it was a holdover from the last discussion session, was we talked about needing a timeline. And as far as any timeline, there's nothing evidently that we decided on anything for a timeline for the superintendent's goals and the org chart.
Well, the org chart was separate.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, it was. It was two different items. But those, I'm kind of combining them. Well, let's just have another item.
No.
So, can we have a discussion on this, board members? Dr. Adams, start with you.
Typically, the org chart comes out, you know, later, either last in May or first of June, in terms of changes, administrative and organizational type of changes. Like today, we're going to have some discussion prior, you know, to give you some heads up on some things that we're thinking, but in terms of movement, it's really needs to be late May, early June.
Okay. So we're gonna look at late May or early June for the org chart. Now we need to talk about the superintendent's goals, and we do not want to do what we did this past year. That's not good for you. It's not good for the organization. It's definitely not good for board members because I forget, but it was October.
Yeah,
Ms. Jimenez.
Yeah, I personally, I think if we really want to avoid setting goals after the school year has begun, these goals should be set jointly during the summertime. Before our deadline to us as a board should be these goals should be in place before school starts. Mm-hmm. So the superintendent knows what she's starting with, as opposed to doing it once school starts and then we start having these meetings. I don't think it does anybody, it's not a win-win for anyone.
Okay, well, it's April. And we already know we have some, you know, July is a one-shot deal. So are we looking at a May-June time frame, board members? Is that what we're looking at? Dr. Adams, is that unrealistic?
I think if you look at a June, you know, you got that one in July and first of August, you know, if you looked at that time frame and you started some discussion on it and more formalizing it by the first of August and really formalizing it before school starts. We can have discussion on it. And I will tell you that from my perspective, some of them will be continuing. You know, when you're talking about student achievement, you should be talking about continuous improvement, so we'll move some of those forward and, you know, move the bar. But I think what's really important, too, is are there some specific areas that the board feels like we need to move in certain directions. So those will be the pieces and parts that I think will be really important.
Well, that's why I was saying we need to have have a board discussion with mm-hmm. you, a designated amount of time with you regarding goals, as we did mm-hmm. last year. We did it way past what would be appropriate for you to then mm-hmm. take those goals. They need to filter down through your mm-hmm. Administrators at the school sites. They need to filter down to teachers.
That's right.
You're August. You're
those replacement school starts, so everybody's yes. aware of what they are.
I don't have internet access, but if anybody has their toys, if we can see what's going on, maybe end of July. I know that early July the board is usually not available, but if we could have that conversation and start talking about goals late July, then we can consolidate first week of August, and then probably the next week for the board meeting mm-hmm. be ready to approve or, you know, make formal whatever those goals are.
And I can be ready with my goals, you know, to the board easily to that end, and then I think it will be important for the board to decide.
So we're looking at late July, first week to do a finalizing goals, first week of August. And what are they going to get to? I'm just trying to back us up, guys.
Pretty fast.
That is way too. That's way fast.
Well, I just put something out there to start the conversation.
Ms. Disney.
Well.
Yes, thank you.
Last year we had quite, you know, the change. We really did some transformational stuff with the way we were going to evaluate the goals that were set, the format, everything, you know. So that was many meetings to do all that. We don't have to do all of that this year. But what I'd like to know is when you're going to present your report back to the board. That's going to be prior to June 1, isn't it?
Oh, yes. It's May.
So that is when we can actually begin, is once you've done your report back. And so I think a meeting in June before we break.
Well, that's what I said. Yeah.
June, July, when we come back.
Yeah. June, July. Okay. And not July, August. Because August is done.
Right. Well, August might be the formality of approval, or, you know, the action on it, but I think the early June and the late July meeting would probably be the meat of the work.
Okay. How about if Dr. Adams and I sit down with some dates? We'll send it out as proposed. Anybody can jump right in and say what their concerns are. And Ms. Simchik?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Because this will be my first go-round. And I did pull out the evaluation. I've been going over it. And I actually think that it's well-written. It's almost like when, before you evaluate, it lists, and it's almost goal-written, mm-hmm. if you've seen
mm-hmm.
it. So, the May report will help me. But additionally, I just have been in government way too long. I just think it's a lot of goals and objectives, unless they're specific. It's a lot of work. I'm not saying not to bother, but I'm just saying just a few specific goals and objectives. And I did wanted, but you clarified, who was putting it? Are we setting the goals, or was Dr. Adams telling us about the goals, or is it a combination?
It's a combination. She gives her goals. We do a collaboration of the two, and I will tell you, if you think there's a lot of goals, you should have seen it a couple of years ago. There were way too many goals for anybody to be addressing.
And that's what happened, so I'm glad that we're all on the same page.
Thank you. Ms. Jimenez.
Yeah, and I think another part of that history with the evaluation is that we're not only looking for goals, but we're looking for ways to have accountability around those goals, because sometimes they tend to be very vague. And it's very difficult to assess, and it becomes very subjective. So when you have artifacts that need to be presented, that allows everyone to do a better assessment. One comment that I did want to make is that one of, you know, looking at the evaluation and getting ready to receive the superintendent's materials, one of the challenges that we continually face is that we don't get our results until after we have done our evaluation. And I can't recall right now what school district it was, but recently a school district voted to wait until they had results to really submit a final evaluation. Because I recall last year that was one of my comments on my report, and I could not just say everything is perfect because I'm missing information. And so my assessment reflected that. And I think it's a shame that that's the way it has to be, and it will be the same this year, that I have to give it incomplete because I haven't seen the results, and I can't just do it on good faith because that's just not the way we hold people accountable, regardless of how great a job they're doing. So that's always a challenge, and I don't know that there's anything we could do about it, but I was intrigued that a school district was able to move that.
You call the school district?
No, I'll go back and look at it.
Perhaps Ms. DeGressa, because we have to remember we have a contract with the superintendent with some expected actions to be taken. So if Ms. DeGressa could clarify. Yes, we do need to do that. And the good thing is that we have gone through so much of the process is that, you know, we are going to have, and we discussed when we had multi-year goals, we're going to have, continue to have multi-year goals. Yes, Ms. Diz.
Thanks. Well, one of the ideas that I liked last summer was when we talked about doing a mid-year evaluation, mm-hmm. and that would certainly cover those high school scores
right.
that we don't get back in time to do right. set summertime goals. You know, since we're getting them back mm-hmm. in fall, if we did a January or December, whatever, evaluation, mm-hmm. that would cover those things.
Yes, anymore we don't get data back until so.
Right. Yeah.
Again, we need, just like we do with our teacher's contract, we need to make certain yeah. we address that in the parameters of the contract we currently have with our draft. So, direction to our board attorney that we do need some information on that.
And if you find out in that district, yeah. let us know.
And actually, since we're talking about dates and we're talking about calendars, I need to bring up one little thing, and I'm sorry I'm going to segue into this, but I think it's the appropriate time. You know, we decided as a board that when board members were not going to be available, that the only thing that was going to be posted on our calendar was board member not available. Well, we've run into a couple of issues, and I thank Ms. Stang very much because she called and said, you know, this just says board member not available. I'm not sure who's going to be gone or how many people are going to be gone. It's also an instrument for staff to know who or who is not going to be here. So I'm bringing it up one more time, and I promise that you know, if you don't want something to say, or if you don't have to list it, but if it needs to be noted in some way that, you know, Johnson not available, you know, has been on there a couple of times, and when the board gave direction to just say board member not available, a couple of times now. When calls have come in and it's been difficult for Ms. Stang, it's also been just one time for Dr. Adams' office, who is or who is not here. So can we have just a little brief conversation about that, Ms. Jimenez?
Sure. I don't understand what the complication is from the perspective of the public calendar doesn't mention names. But my assumption has always been that our secretary would know. You know, for example, I know when I'm not in town, I email the secretary and I say, I'm not going to be here these days. She knows the days and my name. And I think that if we all did that, if you're not going to be available, the calendar can say board member not available, but our assistant knows the name of the person and the date, so that if the superintendent calls and says, I'd like to meet with Ms. Jimenez, our secretary can look at wherever she has her little cheat sheet and says, oh, she is not here today, she'll be back tomorrow. Or Ms. Johnson, no, she's not here. I don't
okay.
understand
all
why
right.
that's
why we're having
issue.
This conversation. So,
okay.
Ms. Disney?
Well, I agree that since it's a public calendar, too much information puts, mm-hmm. you know, puts us at some amount of risk. You know, if a board member's not available and a conference is showing up on the board calendar, the assumption's made there's a board member out of town.
That's true.
And so that's not a good idea to have that mm-hmm. information publicized. But I think part of the problem that might be happening internally is that when I see a board member's not available, then if something comes up for me, if I make a dentist appointment, I don't notify the board office that I'm mm-hmm. also not going to be available because I see it's already been blocked off.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So that creates a situation because if you want to hold a meeting and you say, well, we can get 4 out of 5, mm-hmm. you may not be able to get 4 or 5 because I know when I see board member not available, I say to myself, oh, that's a day that I can book whatever I need to book. So I think that might be where the problem's arising. So, is that it?
Yes.
Okay.
It's not Ms. Stang. I'm sure Ms. Stang would be happy to send another set of books over there, Ms. Stang. But, yes. And we have not had any emergencies, thank goodness, this year so far, any true emergencies. But in the past, we've had a couple of occasions where there needed to be a board quorum for some things that have been done. And if we don't know who to be calling, and if a board member has decided, even though they're going to be in town, to do exactly what you said, they're going to be here, but they're not going to be available. So, Ms. Simchick, did you have any comments on I know we're putting you on the hot seat for somebody who hasn't had to deal with this for very long.
No,
but
I'm very willing to just, in the real world, you just can't have that out there. But I'm very not opposed to having my name out there, but I understand there's a problem with that. I mean, really, police officers are protected in this day and age. I believe anybody to do school board, you just don't want people to think you're not home.
Well, there are lots of boards that have lots of, they have a lot of policies in place.
But, you know, but the second, a second set of notification, I mean, I had made that assumption that Ms. Stang knew, had that information, it just was not for public view. Mm-hmm. So I would probably agree with that.
Yeah, and I just want for the record to say that I'm not saying that Ms. Stang is not doing the job.
No.
I just want that to be clear. I think it's that we make these assumptions that, you know, we all give that kind of information, and then it also becomes, everybody has a personal calendar and has a life. And you can't always be, okay, I'm going to go to the dentist, I'm going to go to the supermarket.
Yeah, we don't need to know if you're going to the supermarket, but you might,
hey, I might be in Orlando. I'm just kidding.
That's me. And I will say she's very good about it. I do try and let Ms. Stang know if I'm in Orlando with family, as you all know, it's an issue with me. That's okay. That's all right. I won't know the grudge. That's all right. Moving on. Okay, so we do have direction. I'll work with Ms. Stang. Well, actually, I'll let Ms. Stang make suggestions to me, and then we'll let you know what she comes up with. So, but I think she understands what our intent is, and it might be something, I don't know how they're going to do it, but it needs something that can be shared quickly with the superintendent's office. So that's part of it. So, okay, and Ms. Jimenez.
Yes, I'd like to follow up on item number 3. At the last discussion meeting, we talked about weighted classes, and there were two issues around this. That what discretion does the school district have in terms of weighting specifically honors classes? AP, IB, and dual enrollment are statutorily defined in terms of weighting, but honors classes are not. So that was one question, and Dr. Adams had agreed to get information from her staff and bring forth information today. And then the second item was the weighting of career education courses. And, you know, this is why it's good to ask these questions, because I've been informed that the state actually prints out a list of what those courses are, and I'm sure Dr. Adams will explain that, so I really appreciate getting that information shared.
Okay.
So, regarding the first item, and that has to do with weighted grades, and the way it's always been in Indian River County is honors, international baccalaureate, advanced placement, and dual enrollment courses receive the same weight. Okay, and it's weighted in terms of you get 1.0 additional points for the grade, whatever the grade is in those classes. The conversation has come up over the last couple of years. It's been discussed at different times regarding should honors courses be weighted the same as the AP, IB, and dual enrollment. And particularly the advanced placement and the international baccalaureate programs are programs that are, you're compared with every other student across the world that takes these same exams, okay? And an honors class, it's local, determined by what the teacher gives you in that grade. You're not compared with others. And by statute, dual enrollment must be weighted at the same as international baccalaureate and advanced placement. So the question was taken to the two high schools, and we asked the two high schools to talk to their leadership team, to their SAC, and to their student government, and put this question before them in terms of the difference in the weighting. And I would say there was good discussion, but it came back unanimously that they agree that the international baccalaureate advanced placement classes should be weighted higher. There is some issue with the dual enrollment, but we have no choice on that. So the dual enrollment would be weighted the same, and that the honors class would be given a 0.5 additional. So what I would propose is that we put that into our student progression plan, and that we would make it, put it into effect with next year's incoming ninth graders, okay? Because you want to start with the incoming class.
So you're not changing the rules on somebody.
No. So you're not changing the rules on somebody who's already there getting ready to graduate. Okay.
So going into ninth grade, an honors class, if I understand, I just want to make sure, we'll get 0.5.
That's correct.
Instead of the full point.
Correct.
Thank you.
Correct. And we do have middle school students that take some honors classes. Okay, so they too would get that same weighting. It would be universally applied across the district. So if you're a middle school student and you're taking honors algebra, you would get that weighting, whatever applies to the. Yes.
Question.
She's back here. Okay. So she's.
But I immediately think about students that are in honors algebra and honors geometry are our top students, and they don't have the ability to take an AP class in a middle school.
That's correct.
So then they won't get the same weighting. So will that change that look?
No, they will still get the same weighting. They will still get the 0.5. So all honors classes will get an additional weighting.
What I'm saying is right now they get a 1.
That will change.
And so that will change. So
yes.
The students that are our highest in middle school won't be eligible to take an AP class in the middle school unless we start offering AP in the middle school.
Yeah, which we don't have any intention of doing that right now.
So that's going to put a cog in the wheel. Just saying.
Just a minute. I'm sorry.
So the really important thing is I think there's agreement at all levels that one should be weighted differently than the other. Mm-hmm. And like I said, what I do give the schools credit for is there was some good discussion between students, parents, and the staff as well. And so I think in terms of our own policy, that's a good thing to do. The second thing that Mrs. Jimenez had asked about was the career and technical classes.
Okay, before we get off of this,
just wanted to use a practical example to make sure I understand. So
yes.
If you have an eighth grader, let's say, taking Algebra 1.
Honors.
And they would have gotten a point this year, but starting August when they go actually in and that GPA counts, they'll get a half point. We're changing it from a point to a half a point.
You're saying if they've already taken it, they have
They're completing it in June,
and
now they're starting high school. As you said, we'd start with the ninth graders.
That's what you said.
So when they're coming into ninth grade.
So it starts in ninth grade, so we've got to go back and make sure that it's fairly applied to all students.
Eighth graders going into ninth.
Yeah.
So they'll be starting a year if they take one or two courses. Would you consider Spanish as well?
The courses that are honors courses are level 3 classes, which are designated by the state. Okay, so you can have Spanish 1 or you can have an honors Spanish 1 class, but that's a level 3 class, which is designated course code by the state.
So they immediately start high school in ninth grade with their GPA plus a half a point, if I'm understanding that right.
If they took an honors
if
course
they
in
took
middle
an honors.
School, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, any honors level courses, they will get the additional weighting.
Thank you.
Okay,
the part that I'm having a hard time with is moving forward after next year's student progression plan, it's going to be 6.5 for honors.
Mm-hmm.
But if they took the class before the like if they take it this year in eighth grade, they're getting 1 point.
Yeah. And
next year, they could get their 1 point because...
No, so they
get 1 point this year, and then next year would become half a point? You're not going to grandfather them in?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We're not going to change grade point averages. When it changes for everybody.
Okay.
But we'll go back and look at those. Those are the nuances that when you change one rule, it's not quite so easy. You have to go back and see what the ripple is on everybody.
Okay. Ms. Susie, I haven't sat down and done the math. It seems to me that we need to look at the cohorts and start in middle school.
Yeah.
And have next year's first, you know, telling the kids next year, starting in middle school, that the point value is going to change and then let it work its way
we'll
up.
Look at that.
Okay.
Rather than start in ninth grade, we need to start with middle school. Well, so that the cohorts usually, all have it.
And I think that's what Beth was trying to say to me. You know, remember, they take it earlier.
And if you can come back with information after you do your...
You will, because we probably will put something in the students' version.
Okay, in the second half...
And the second half was how is it determined, maybe, what career technical classes receive honors credit? And that is determined, again, by the state. There's no local control over that. And so let me give you a couple of examples. In accounting, when a student takes accounting as a career technical class, they get an honors. It's a level 3 course for accounting 1, accounting 2, and accounting 3. Okay? If a student takes drafting, drafting 1 is not a level 3, it's a level 2. Drafting 2 is a level 2. And drafting 3 is a level 3 course where they get honors credit. So it varies. It's not the same in all courses. So you can't make an assumption that because counting 1, 2, and 3 is honors, that drafting 1, 2, and 3 will be honors, because that's not the case. So the students receive information. I even have an example of what Vero Beach High School puts out, their registration forms for 9th, 10th, and 11th graders, and they indicate what courses are level 3 courses, and so students are made aware, you know, of that. So I think Mrs. Jimenez's original question really thought maybe we had some local control on...
Right.
Designating those courses as honors, which we do not.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that, because we did receive that email from a parent. It was specifically about drafting. And
yes.
I think, you know, this is another example of the importance of communicating and making sure that our parents really understand, because it's easy to misunderstand when you say, well, if accounting 1, 2, and 3 are honors.
Right.
Why not drafting 1, 2, and 3, and that's beyond our purview.
Counting's a lot cooler.
No comment.
Okay, that's the answer.
That is going to be new information to a lot of parents, that the classes are not automatically level 1, level 2, level 3, you know, based on the years that the students have in the class. That's new information to parents, so that's something that, you know, now that we have more and more parents involved in the quest for the highest GPA and all that kind of stuff, that's...
And like I said, I have some really good examples of how the schools, you know, the school gets that information out to the students at registration. So
Dr. Adams, can you leave that out your desk with your assistant?
Okay.
Anybody needs that? Okay, Mr. McCain. Ms. Simchick. Okay, Ms. Disney.
I'll wait for board committee report.
Okay, it's my turn. I'd like to bring up an issue that has been brought up both by the union and by just one phone call and one email, but it's been brought up regarding the use of Mr. Helsby. We had, actually Dr. Adams and I talked about this before the issue came up from the union and from a union representative email and the one phone call that I received. And before I get into my thoughts as to why I want to bring this up, would you tell me what Mr. Helsby is doing at the moment?
We still have Mr. Helsby at this point noted as the chief negotiator. Okay. We have just really recently come out of impasse where we've been dealing with many of the issues for quite a long time and still have some carryover. Mr. Housby at this point is really more of a consultant, I would say, to Mr. Fritz than on an ongoing basis. We're using him, less, but he's still an important consultant and guide to Mr. Fritz. So we still have ongoing things that we've been talking about, both in CWA and IRCEA, and his counsel is still important to us. It's a lot of pretty legalistic these days in terms of the issues that you're dealing with, but we anticipate that Mr. Fritz will take over that role as chief negotiator, but still hope to have Mr. Housby as a counsel to him when needed.
Board members, need your input, and then I'll discuss my thoughts live.
I'm glad that this has been brought up, because I think the understanding, especially because Mr. Fritz's position was vacant for a while, was that we needed Mr. Helmsby to step in during that transition time. And I understand that he needs to transition out, that he's still a consultant, but what is the timeline that you see for Mr. Fritz stepping into the role of chief negotiator?
I would say, I think it would be fair to say that next school year, that this summer as we transition out, or after July 1, I think you could be at the chief negotiator with counsel when needed.
Ms. Simchick?
Thank you. I really had my questions answered about this subject, and I understood the history in the background. And personally, I felt that I had no reason to even ask Dr. Adams, that I would have been aware when his bill reached $50,000, which was her cap, then we'd have to be aware of it. But you can use anyone you want for your consulting. And that's how I feel about Dr. Adams, that she has that good judgment, and that if she wanted to continue to use him, that would be fine, because she has her dollar limit set in place. But I'm glad that you do have a plan, but I personally wouldn't hold you to that timeline if extended. So thanks for sharing your information.
My dominant feeling on the negotiation in general was that I was very pleased to see the tenor of the conversation when I attended, and that because Mr. Fritz comes from another state, that this longer period of guidance or mentoring or however you want to look at it, it was really important. This board is so unique, and I think that they were working together as a great team, and that sounds like a good time frame for phasing, kind of reversing the roles, as it were.
Mr. McCain, do you have any comments? Well, with all due respect to Mr. Fritz, Mr. Fritz has a lot of other responsibilities besides negotiating issues, and just my opinion, but I will tell you that when we sit down at the table and we have two out of county, two people who are not part of the executive board of the IRCEA, and they have come in with a special expertise, I think we would be doing ourselves a disservice if we did not in some way allow Mr. Fritz, or when Dr. Adams feels there is a crisis, critical situation, for her to start the ball rolling on certain issues. Mr. Helmsby, I think, has, in my opinion anyway, he's done a good service to the board, but I think we need a level playing field. Why would we want to completely dismiss somebody who has been effective just because we have hired someone full-time in HR? If that person was only, if we were a big county and we were only hiring an HR, someone in HR as a negotiator, that would be fine. But I think we need that outside expertise, just as IRCEA does when they sit down with that. So I'm pleased at your plan. I'm pleased. I've been very pleased with Mr. Fritz, and his knowledge has certainly grown, because he came from a state that this is all new. All of this is new for him. But obviously, he's a quick learner. He made a good choice. So,
but I would want to repeat that Mr. Helsby will be a good counsel to us in the future. And the other thing I would like to say about him is the tenor with everybody has always been the same. He is a very professional person. He's respectful, and I've never seen anything other than that as he works with people. So I have the greatest regard for his level of knowledge and expertise.
So I just thought we needed to clarify that. That's why I put it on the part of my agenda for today, was that we needed to give Dr. Adams direction. Even though she has the authority without our direction, she certainly can continue to do that after the 13-14, hopefully, is closed. But it's someone nice to have waiting in the wings when we need that additional expertise. We want a level playing field for both sides. It's not, it wouldn't be in our best interest to take away something and become a three-legged stool. So even a three-legged stool, just sit. Okay.
And I would also like to give Mr. Fritz some credit, because I think he has really been working closely with the with both unions and trying to develop this, this trust and openness and transparency, and I think that he's done a good job with that.
Ms. Jimenez.
Hey, I just wanted to bring up the high-speed rail conversation. I know that, Karen, you attended the MPO meeting, and you mentioned it in your report, and I got a phone call from a local group that's organizing in the community around this, and I just wanted to bring it forth again just to make sure that we don't have any specific issues around schools that are near railroads or a, you know, one of the things, and I don't understand all the particulars about, you know, the plan itself, but with more trains running through the county, hypothetically, in the future, there could be safety issues, especially with school buses having a protocol to stop and, you know, look both ways, and, you know, that kind of education and training. I don't know what our, if there's a need for us as a board to stay on top of this issue. I'm comfortable with it coming through MPO because that's where it will be discussed. I know that there's an environmental impact study that will be released probably next in May. So I just wanted to put that out there because there's so much in the paper, pro, con, all kinds of takes on it, and I just wanted to make sure that we as a school board are aware and are following this issue and think about how it might impact us.
Well, aside from the neighborhood impacts, when I look at it from a school district point of view, it's Gifford Middle School that we particularly want to have, I suppose you'll have our director of facilities looking and making sure that there isn't an issue with noise there, vibrations, with both, which can be mitigated in some fashion. But, of course, the greatest of all is safety, because we do have students that cross that track to get to Gifford. So we want to make sure that we look at that hard and get our request for mitigation in quickly before the decision-making is completed, where we have the most leverage.
Ms. Sanchez?
No, I would agree.
Oh. Well, let me just clarify a couple of things. I'm not advocating for anything, but I think you need some information. The city of Vero Beach, within the city limits, they do have a an ordinance that was passed that trains can only go a certain amount of speed within the city limits. That's why you see these 100-120 car trains that take forever within the city limits. It is my understanding, I don't have anything in writing, but it is my understanding in a secondhand manner that the city of Vero Beach is not going to require that of those high-speed trains, hence the name high-speed train. And you're not looking, you're probably looking at anywhere from an 8 to maybe a 12 car inconvenience. So you're not looking at these law, I mean, they're not going to do anything when it comes to any of the whatchamacallit cars. They're not going to do any of those rail cars. There aren't going to be any rail cars attached to this. And it's strictly going, and in the beginning, it's probably going to be very few, but it, unless the city of Vero Beach is pressured into requiring them to do the slowdown, which they require of the rail cars, I doubt it's going to make much of, a, of an impression as far as an impact to us. So they'll be in and they'll be out. When you're looking at the safety, that's going to be a quick, it's going to go by before you know it. So, but high-speed rail, and I don't know what the final decision is. The final decision will lay with the city council. And if they should decide that they want slowdown, then that's what will happen, slowdown. So that becomes then a time situation, mm-hmm. and it also becomes certain possible delays. So, you know, for a safety issue, letting them, but, you know, it remains to be seen. And there's a lot of folks who felt as though Vero Beach should be a stop along the way, and I can understand that, because there are folks probably who'd like to go to Orlando or south, but I don't think that's realistic for a community such as ours as far as readership, leadership usage.
Ridership.
Thank you, ridership. it's sort of like we had when we our last provider for flying from here to Orlando International. You know, the last few months of his contract, he was just hanging on by a thread because nobody was using it on a regular basis, and it was very difficult monetarily, but he was tied to a contract with the airport, so he had to fulfill his contract, and he did. So, but I don't think, as far as a safety issue, I agree. The thing I was concerned about was the Gifford Middle School and the fact that we do have so many. You see them mm-hmm. walking across that railroad track and down with Dixie. So it makes a big difference. It makes a big difference.
What's the end of
the I'm sorry.
At the presentation from Board Florida was made to MPL, and that's where public citizen, the citizenry are coming to object for support the rail. And, you know, county commissioners and city councilmen make up that board as well as myself. I don't see my role as advocating for or against it without clear direction from my own board. My job is that if it goes through, to make sure that the schools that are impacted are taken care of. So, and correct me if
who's
you see me.
I've been in a
level.
Hole for 2 months. Mm-hmm.
Decision.
I don't want to get the paper. When is this? Where does this stand? What's happening there?
Oh, 2015, they should be carrying paying passengers.
And when's the decision going to be made?
Summer, I believe. The report's due in May, and so I would think by summer. Because there's some number of miles of rail that still need to be laid between the airport and 95. And then they will be using the corridor that's already in place that runs north and south.
So you mentioned the possibility of a mitigation request for Gifford Middle. Who does that? Is that our staff?
I wrote that down.
Okay.
I hadn't heard that before, so you know, I'm glad you brought that up. Mm-hmm. But I'd have to go.
And there may not be an impact, as Mrs. Johnson was saying. When you only have 6 or 8 cars versus 100 cars, you have a whole different impact to the area. And also, they're supposed to be hornless. From what the current plan is right now, is they're hornless because of the amount of safety equipment that's being installed. But someone spoke to MPO last time I was there about the vibrations and what it can do to chemistry labs and what it can do to equipment in the school hospital. So,
how close is it to the hospital?
You know, but the engineers can come in and looking at the distance and the condition of the school and all that, tell you what, if any, impact there will be to the school.
Ms. MJ?
Also, from what I understand, that grant money for the mitigation is a match, and I could be wrong. So even though if you apply, it would be they'll give you $100,000, but you've got to match the $100,000. So that may be something that's not so that would be important to find out. All those things that you brought up, how much will it affect it, and then what is the grant match?
Yes.
And then in today's paper, there was an article on the front page about some higher level of mitigation, and the president or the executive director of the company said that that would not be budgeted because it's too expensive. It would add something like $47 million to their budget, so they're not even considering it, which, you know, I think if you live in an area where it would be of concern, that kind of sends a message. But I don't know that affects us at all. So there's a lot of conversation.
But it's good to be having awareness, and that's exactly what we need at these discussion sessions, is awareness and things that we're hearing, seeing, et cetera. Let's see, Ms. Disney, did you have anything else after that?
No, I'll wait for committee report.
You said that. Ms. Simchek, you didn't have anything, Mr. McCain, Ms. Jimenez. And then after Ms. Jimenez does hers, then we'll take a break so we can get staff here.
Okay.
We'll take a quick break. Yes, Ms. Simchek.
I wasn't sure if I was going to bring it up because you had mentioned about speaking, and then speaking on behalf of other members, and you had just mentioned it about the being on the MPO and taking a position. So I want to approach this ever so delicately, because it's only because I did not come in the beginning of the year. So when we, but this is just an example, so I don't want anybody to take offense. It's just knowing clarification for me to know, I think I know my position and limits, but I want to make sure. What prompted this was, there was an email from board member Jimenez as the legislative liaison, and it was well written and some very good points, but I wasn't sure if it was written as personal person, Ms. Jimenez, board member Jimenez speaking for us, and just to see if that, the first place, so I decided to see that, you know, I just came in. So let me see where our thoughts were. So I did go and try to find the, and this was our board, I was able to get a copy, and I asked Dr. Adams for a copy. They did not know why, but what was our legislative priorities? And so I took that, and I tried to mirror to make sure that this letter that was written from the school board computer mirrored the policies, because it was speaking for us. And 99.9% of it did. But there was some things in there that were not. And I'm just saying, there were some things that were not in these policies. And so I'm not sure where that, you know, although they may or may mirror what I say, but they did not mirror the policies that we adopted. So I'm not, and this is not a specific issue, but this was a good way to express what the point I'm trying to clarify. How is this board, and you had brought up that you wouldn't take a position unless you came back. How are we addressing, you know, correspondence when we speak outside? This letter was for the Florida Senate Education Committee. And as I said, it went out by a board member, so I wasn't sure. How are we to handle? Now, I'm not going to send, although I sat on Ellesmere, and we'll get to those things, but I did not express a position for the school board about the 19,000 homes that are coming for elementary schools and middle school, because I don't know the board's position. And not having this, like I said, I wasn't sure. So how are we handling it?
Then well, first of all, let me just clarify that document was officially approved by the board. However, we've had other discussions, and I don't know what the 0.1% that was not mirrored there, but it could have been part of our discussions when we talk about direction.
Okay.
Because that's been adopted, yes, that is there, but we also, there are things that happen during the school year.
Exactly.
That can't be added to that. So I think to be defensible, perhaps we need to hear Ms. Jimenez's thought processes, but and I won't speak for you.
Well, that letter was written at the direction of the board, and I believe you were here when the board gave direction as your legislative liaison that I
right about this issue in particular because it's going through the legislature. Mm-hmm. One thing that's important to be mindful of is that as an issue comes before the legislature, there are a lot of other points that can be used as arguments to convince or try to dissuade our legislators from supporting them. And those points will not necessarily be here because that is really a platform. Mm-hmm. So there is really, this platform cannot be used in its entirety to represent one issue. And I think this issue, if you just let me look at it, because I've been, this was the education accountability. Mm-hmm. So there are things that came up that mm-hmm. the Commissioner of Education wants to do that we didn't know when we wrote our platform. So basically what I did to make sure that I honored what the board wanted was I also contacted Mr. Crawford and Ms. Melton, all of the Florida School Board Association lobbyists, and I got talking points for them mm-hmm. from them, and then I reread them, made sure that they agreed with what we've been talking about. But I did that under the direction of the board. I did not take it upon myself. Whenever I write letters to my legislators, mm-hmm. when I do it as a citizen, I don't write that I'm representing the school board, because that's me as a, you know, like I wrote to Senator Galvano. He mm-hmm. pulled the voucher bill. I was very grateful. So I said, thank you so much. But I did it as myself because I didn't get direction from the board to do that. But this had board direction. And I think because of the specific issue, a lot of the arguments would not have been in our platform because that came up after the fact. So I hope that answers your question, but I think it's an excellent question because we need to be mindful of how we represent the board.
Especially when someone comes in midstream. Mm-hmm. That's all. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks. Each November, the legislative liaison is appointed. But our practice has been, even though it can be appointed by the chair, our practice has been that we all approve that appointment. Because of the nature of representing all of us in a legislative arena, while we develop a platform that we approve with action, there are items that come up throughout the year, and we have to rely on our legislative liaison to represent us accurately. So we can give direction, but we are not going to micromanage or wordsmith each letter that goes out because there's quite a few of them that do. So that approval in November is a vote of confidence that our legislative liaison will represent us accurately with integrity and go before the legislature with the intent of the board.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, to honor your question, I am happy moving forward, whenever I am asked to contact the legislator or send out a letter, I'm happy to send it to the board members for any feedback. The only thing I would ask is that it be prompt feedback, because some of these are time sensitive, and if I don't send it out, by the time I get everybody's input, it'll be too late. So that's the concern.
We give that charge to you as a board. We give direction. Mm-hmm. And I can, Ms. Simchek, doing her due diligence, was trying to equate that, and I was happy to see that she found 99.9% was in line with our legislative package. But I feel as though that muddies the water. We need to take care of it and get it done. We don't need, you know, four other people wordsmithing any of this, in my opinion. So, board members, anybody else have
anything? No, and I just, and then thank you. This is all I wanted was clarification, which I think is
perfect. How about if we take a 7-minute break?
Could I have one more comment?
Oh, sure.
I've done the job for 7 years, and I so appreciate Mrs. Jimenez taking the job this year. It's a tough job. It's year-round. It's not just the 8 weeks of the legislative session. And there's constantly fires to put out. So I wanted to let you know how much I appreciate what a great job you do.
I'll second that.
I just wanted to say,
as long as he doesn't have to do it.
For Mrs. Simchek, that when we do the board platform, it's very broad, usually in nature, mm-hmm. when we first do it. And then it's really the particulars come forward as time goes on and the session gets in. And we get a lot of good feedback from our legislative liaisons like Bern Crawford and Ruth Melton. They're good resources for us to go to. But the platforms are usually pretty broad at the beginning.
Okay, our 7-minute break is now 6 minutes.
All right. She's tough.
All right, so I'm going to get harder.
formula. Can you put the student boys in there, not pass my evaluation?
Are we ready?
Yes.
We're on.
I'd like to reconvene our discussion session. We are grateful that Dr. Adams had some issues we need to be addressing today and some additional information. So, if you'd like to start with Dr. Adams.
I've invited Mr. Fritz to come in, and actually...
You know what? We're going to do board committee reports first.
Oh, okay. Let's go ahead and do that.
But you can
everybody
stay.
Will be in.
You can stay.
Can I stay at the table, or would you like me to move to the chair?
I'd like for you to stay at the table.
Okay.
Keep Ms. DeGrasse straight so that we can talk
Please.
About it.
Okay. Usually she keeps me straight. Okay.
Ms. Simmons, I'll start with you.
Okay. I'm actually... going to do this during the board meeting because I have an update for legislative and it'll be the same information, so I'd rather just
wait a minute.
Just do it all at once.
Now I know why you used to do that.
We basically went over the MPO issue already.
Okay.
Legislative day on the on the Hill happens March 19th, 20th, whatever, and we haven't spoken really about it since then, but there's a number of things that are really churning up there right now, and Claudia's going to go into some of them later, but the point I wanted to make about it is if all of us are not participating in the conversation about public education, we're letting down everything that's happening in public education. Public education is not just the best chance for many of our children. It's the only chance that they have. And we have to go from being passive about public education and just sort of hunkering down and doing our work to being very vocal about what it is that our kids need and speaking up when something incorrect is stated. Just as you were talking about earlier, there's a local citizen who stated in a couple of different arenas something that's totally inaccurate about our school district, and rather than respond in a public way, we just sort of, you know, don't draw attention to those things. And the competition for the dollars is so intense, the competition for the students is so intense, and the information that is out there is so frequently misstated that we have got to be much more vocal about it. And I think that this board, not at this meeting, but at another meeting, perhaps we can have a conversation about our responses to the public. The system that we have right now is very cumbersome. You know, our many of our citizens are starting right at the board level, giving us feedback. We are, five of us, answering, and then forwarding these messages on to our attorney and our assistant superintendents and our superintendents and our principals. So now we have all these people responding, and often it isn't the same message. So we may want to have a conversation about how we do respond to many of these issues, not only for everyone's time efficiency, but so that the message is uniform and that it's correct.
Thank you. Ms. Sinchuk, do you have any board committee report?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Sebastian was canceled, however. Elsner did have an amendment to the comp plan for Felsmere Farms, a.k.a. SunAg, a.k.a. there's a lot of names for it, over 18,000 acres. Obviously, the reason that I will tell you that tripped it was because they want to develop the business end of it, the industrial end of it. But be aware, who knows if there is a rebound on building. It is slated to have over 19,000 residences, four elementary schools and a middle school. I know they worked with Scott Sanders and spoke about it. Their staff with Scott, who's very helpful. Obviously, the land is slated to be donated, which may be more. The donation of their land makes it more flexible to where they put the schools. I would think we would work with them with that flexibility, but they'll obviously take the credits for the donation of the land. And I don't see that as. I just wanted to report to the board. It's there. It's that
ghost town because there's nothing. We know it's there, and we'll be long off the board when we have to. But I just did want to report back that that is a 4 elementary school, 1 middle school projection just for those 8,000. And, you know, there's many hamlets. You know, they're like little towns that within this super area. So that's really, I just want to say they had an amendment based on this business industrial area. They've got a nibble, and they had to amend their comp plan to allow for this. So it was an interesting meeting, but that's all I have.
So I have a question on that. Is that Indian River, Osceola, and counties? I mean, does that take up more than one county? Is that 19,000?
No. It is
acres,
all
Indian River?
It actually is before it gets to 60. It would start at 512 and go
all
the way to almost 60. And it would be, you know, a little south of Willow and
yes,
that whole area.
Yes.
It's also the old Sunag or something. And that was, if you recall, that was the trip factor when Felsmere annexed it to the charter debate. So that's a very large chunk of, you know, like a build it and they will come. But the way our economy is, it, you know, and they're within, they were annexed by the city, so we nothing can stop that. But just the economy may stop that. It's a wish list.
Right.
But what's tripping it now is the industrial business end of it, that they have to reconfigure their comp plan to allow for this. This one nibble that's starting to come through. So that's what happened at the last meeting last week, and that's all I have.
Thank you very much. That's an iteration of the previous package that had been presented that was going to require $1 million worth of facilities. It's just been downsized and reconfigured somewhat to the current comp.
Okay.
Mr. McCain, any committee reports?
Not that would be of any interest here.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a personal problem. And I don't have any committee reports. So now, Dr. Adams, we can get started.
Yes, a couple of things. I've asked Mr. Fritz to come in for a couple of reasons. One is on the board agenda tonight, we have the turnkey modular for the health clinic. And so we wanted to give you a little more explanation about how did that happen. You know, we have two computables there that we talked about. So we want to give you a little, we want to give you some background information on that. And then the second thing that I'll just let him go into when he's finished is there are also some job descriptions on the agenda tonight for which we don't have jobs right now, but we want to give him an opportunity to give you an idea of what his vision is for HR. And as we move forward, and it's nothing until the organizational chart moves forward and is approved, but it gives you some background information.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Adams, and thank you for inviting me. So I'd like to start by discussing the progress that we're making on the wellness clinic. As you know, the board approved it a couple of months ago, and we've been busy at work getting ready to open this summer. The first step in this process was to establish a meeting with Care Here. We actually had a series of meetings in order to plan the implementation, and had a meeting on March 6th and then again on March 10th, and there's been some subsequent meetings. And some of the topics of discussion as we've been talking with the vendor are timing and marketing for the program. They also actually have a staff architect who works with them when they work with a school district, who's attended the meetings and also discussed the hiring of the physicians and the staff. So in the initial meeting, their architect and Scott Sanders, who works for us, who's here today, had a conversation about the renovation of the concretable over transportation. And in that conversation, what we realized based on the needs of the vendor, the way the building needs to be set up with, for example, you know, small rooms for diagnostics and you know, the waiting area and things like that, is that the initial estimate on the concretable remodel far surpassed what we had initially thought it would be. The initial thought, if you remember, was that it would be about $135,000. But what we learned is the way the concretable is set up and constructed, there would need to be a lot more infrastructure work. For example, the heating, I would say heating because I'm from the north, the air conditioning, and ventilation system in the building would need to be reworked to have smaller rooms in there because it's set up as one central system with one intake and one outtake. So you'd have to redo all of the ducting in there. Obviously, we need to put up walls, which are not really that expensive, but it's really two concretables attached together. And so being able to make it work as one facility is expensive because you have to go through the concretable wall in order to do that, and those walls are pretty significant. So in conversing about what the potential cost would be of that renovation, it was estimated to be somewhere in the ballpark of $200,000. However, the architect from CareHere, who has basically worked with implementing these in many different school districts and municipalities, pointed out that there was another option, and that is a modular building, portable building option. And they, the person who actually does the portables for the school district, the current person who we work with on that, is the vendor for those, and they have one already designed. And they have one that, in essence, can be put in, and their quote is $130,380, exactly as they've done in other districts where CareHere has done work. So they're familiar with the design. It suits them. It's already established and something that they can put together quickly and get installed. So a number of benefits. Obviously, there's a lower cost to this. It's the same vendor that we already work with, so that is convenient. It's already designed. It's pre-designed for, it's purpose designed for a wellness clinic, and it's faster to put in than the remodeling work would be. And so, Scott continued to work with the architect, and it looks like that's the best course of action in order to be able to open this summer with the clinic. But it's a different plan than the one we had presented to the board earlier as we were thinking about it in the initial stages with the remodeling of concretables. So we wanted to bring it forward and make you aware of it. Obviously, it's over the $50,000 purchase threshold, which is a reason why it's coming to the board meeting tonight. So the subsequent question, once we thought, well, this would be a recommended course of action, was if we put in this building at the transportation facility, we have this concretable sitting there. And we thought, well, it's kind of weird to have a vacant building sitting next to a building that you're using. Additionally, we had envisioned in future years some additional services with the wellness clinic. For example, doing health training, maybe smoking cessation for bus drivers, things like that. X-ray is something that we saw in future years of the health clinic. So in looking at this, the renovation of the existing concretable for those purposes, for classroom space, since they were a classroom space, to segment off one section for future X-ray use, is not very expensive. In fact, estimate is it's about $25,000 to renovate for those purposes. And so the thought was that we would move forward actually with a recommendation to do the that loudly, but I'll
try. It's your magnetic
personality. It must be, yes. It's a magnetic pen. I don't know. So,
would you move yours over to the other side?
I think I'm still on.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, so.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll see for the degrees. Maybe it's her magnetic personality.
I doubt it.
So, at this point, we see those are things that we would possibly do in the future anyway. Additionally, the cost per square foot, when you look at the aggregate of all these things, about $44 per square foot, which is pretty low in the construction world. And we do believe that even at the $25,000 cost, we can probably do it for less by using our internal staff to do the work on it. So our recommendation that we're bringing forth this evening is a purchase of the concretable, piggybacking on the bid from Suwanee County on the modular buildings for $130,000, $130,380,000. and then an additional authorization to remodel the existing concreteable building for a cost of $25,000.
Thank you. Now is the time for questions, not direction, of course. So, Ms. Disney.
Thank you. So please, there was an alternative to the $200,000. I had kind of a lump in my throat for a few minutes there. You're suggesting that we purchase another concreteable and put it in the same general area of the two that exist there so that we can use it as a group of?
Allow me to clarify. It would be the purchase of a modular building. It's not a concreteable. The modular buildings, actually, I think they're, and maybe these guys can help me a little bit, I think they're typically, I mean, it's more like a portable, they're not wood on the outside, they're kind of metal on the outside, similar to the ones we have over at Dodgertown, for example.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, I used the wrong word, but yeah. To put this modular building then in the same location, utilizing the same parking lot
yes.
in the general area.
Yes.
So that we, as we expand the program, we will use the two buildings that are there.
Correct.
With some lesser modifications.
Yes. And there was a picture in your board packet. I brought a copy of it. If you wanted to look at it again, I can pass it around. I only brought one, but you can.
Additional questions? Yes, Ms. Mendez.
So you explained that you did not want to have this modular building next to an empty concreteable. So you're renovating for future use. When it's renovated, is it going to continue being an empty?
So I think that it actually could initially be used for training because it's set up for that purpose. That's easy. The question about X-ray, which is the other piece of it, we have yet to determine. It could be used for future use there. I think we also need to have a conversation with the provider to see whether it makes sense to do that at the outset or whether it makes sense to wait on that. We don't yet know what the volume is going to be, the need for that. We do envision there will be something in the future, but we don't know whether it's something we would initiate at the outset. Probably not. But we would be prepared for that in the future.
Follow-up? Yeah, and as a follow-up, I guess I ask this because we're embarking in this endeavor. It's a risk. We are assuming, you know, we are hopeful that it's going to work out and that it will expand in the future. So your recommendation is that because we are so hopeful that this is going to work, we're willing to renovate a building with the hope of future expansion. That's kind of what I'm hearing.
I think that would describe, our thinking.
And
yeah.
It's worth investing the $25,000.
$25,000 is a fairly small price tag when you consider what we're looking at doing. The other thing we know is construction costs continue to increase, cost of materials, cost of labor. 5 years ago I wouldn't have said that, but I think things have changed, and so we do believe that by doing this now and doing it all at once as part of a package, if you will, it probably would be a more efficient way to do it than to wait to do that renovation in the future.
Thank you.
Most of my questions were answered, but obviously you said it would have been why the renovation now, and you had mentioned training. It can be used as alternative space for training, but also I do like having a solid concreteable next to a portable for evacuation because for tornadoes and things like that, because that's very problematic. I looked everywhere, though. I could not see. Do you know the hurricane rating on the module or module we're buying? Because I could not see that in the packet.
Meets four building codes, 160 mile an hour.
Thank you. That's it.
Who's Disney?
Is there an additional price tag for site work to put the modular?
That's full cost.
That's the full cost.
Full cost. It's all included.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, moving right along.
Okay.
Thank you.
So about 3 weeks ago, I sent a memo to the board related to some changes in job descriptions in the Human Resources Office. And I've been on board, I think, how many months now? 8 months. And I've had an opportunity in working with the Human Resources and Risk Management departments to see how things are functioning. And feel prepared at this point in time to make some recommendations about some direction in future for how we operate. And so sometimes there's an opportunity created by circumstances, and so this is probably something that I would have been bringing forth later on as we look at budget for next year and do our planning probably in July or August. We're working on budget now, but the reorg would happen in the summer. However, we have a vacancy in our department in the safety technician position, and when you have a vacancy, it gives you opportunity to look at the structure and see whether you can use that opportunity at that time rather than have to shift people from one job to another who are already occupying that job to make those changes in the course of that situation. And so in looking at the vacated safety technician position, we also did some thinking about the current manager position in the risk management department. And as you're probably aware, the risk management position in the district is very broad-based. That person is responsible for employee insurance and oversight for that. They provide oversight for safety operations in the district. They provide oversight for workers' compensation as well as general liability, property insurance, etc. And the position really, in at least my analysis and our discussion in the department, discussion with the district leadership team, it's really too broad in scope to be able to do well and effectively in all of those fields. And so in having a open safety technician position, which actually is primarily funded through our insurance company, they actually provide us with resources to help support that position, we thought it best to take the current risk management manager and map him to that safety technician position. He actually has the requisite skills to do that job, has experience in that area, and he and I have talked about this, and he's well prepared for those tasks. In fact, he's doing some of those tasks right now because that other position is vacant. And so it is a downgrade in pay by one pay level in the ProfTech schedule. But what it does is allow the manager position to be vacated so we can create positions that are more specific in responsibility as we move forward. So my recommendation is to basically get rid of the manager position and map Mr. Remley into that other position. We're not doing that yet because we need to have the other job descriptions approved first before we start to take those steps, and we need to fill some positions before we go to that place. So the area that I've been questioning and concerned about is workers' compensation. We actually have seen a stabilizing of the claims there and the cost of the claims, so both number and cost, this year, but we do expect that our mod rate will increase slightly. Actually, it has very little to do with this year. It actually has to do with a historical pattern. Mod rates are determined on a five-year aggregate, and we had a really expensive year in 2012. And as a result of that, that's still in the cycle on the mod rate, and prior to that, the claims have been lower, and since 2012, they've been a little bit higher than they were prior to 2012, so it was kind of flat, went way up, and then it's come down, but not down as far as it was before. So as previous years cycle off and new years roll on, the mod rate still continues to increase a little bit. We do believe that with proper management of the claims, that when the older years roll off, especially when 2012 rolls off of the five-year cycle, we should see a decline in our mod rate. But we do need to do some continued work on managing time loss. We need to do some additional work on developing our light duty structures within the school district so that we can be bringing people back to work. And there does need to be some specialized knowledge of workers' compensation that will help us in order to mitigate those costs later on and really operate in a proactive way to keep our employees safe and from getting injured. Ideally, in a well-functioning workers' comp program, you don't have injuries. And if you don't have injuries, you don't have expenses, you don't have claims, and you don't have time loss and cost to the employer. And we really need a person who is specifically focused on the workers' comp functions of the organization. And so in thinking about that, I did have a conversation with our people with Ascension in our insurance company about that. It's a model that's been used in other places. It's a model that's been effective in other places. I also took the liberty of looking at other school districts that have a structure like that. One example is the St. John's School District, which is up in the St. Augustine area. And actually, the job description that will be before you tonight is very similar to the one they have in St. John's, and they've got an effective program there. And so what we'd like to do is create a position called insurance specialist. That position would be specifically geared toward the routine things with regards to our insurance, but also with regards to true specific management of our workers' compensation claims. So in doing that, and we tried to match the pay level they're using in St. John's, figuring that would be competitive in the market for people who are doing that. I did share that job description with our insurance company, and they believe that both the job description makes sense with what we're trying to do. They also believe that it would be competitive in the salary market at the ProfTech 2 level that's being proposed. So in looking at that and looking at elimination of the manager position, the other piece that's part of that is the employee benefits program. Daryl provides oversight for that, but a majority of that work is happening with Wendy Gardner, who is the employee benefits specialist in our department. And so her previous job description, it's a current job description, I guess, until tonight and a hiring process, it's been a confidential managerial position, and those positions typically are in support of administrative functions in the school district. However, her job responsibilities already have morphed into things that are well beyond being support. She's doing a lot of autonomous, independent decision making, providing guidance and support in the overall employee benefits program, and she's well trusted by her employees. They have a lot of respect for her in that area, and she's got a lot of skills and knowledge. So, because that position has changed over time, it doesn't make sense for that position to be still at the professional. It makes sense for it to move into the professional technical world and out of the confidential managerial world. Because it is a different type of position and a higher pay grade, we would post that position. I would envision that Wendy would be a competitive candidate.
We try not to mention specific names, so yes. We can look at just the positions and that policy for that. And
yes.
But the protocol is that we don't mention specific people's names, if you don't mind.
Okay, and I fully understand that.
It's not a problem. We all need to be reminded that
I wanted to be able to address the question of what happens to the existing employees.
Okay,
so.
But that's not what we do. Yep. So we need to
I understand.
Moving forward. Thank you.
So the position would be moved to a different level, and if you notice, the recommendation at a ProfTech 2 is the same as the insurance specialist position that's being recommended. And really, I envision that those two people would be cross-trained, would know one another's work. They would partner with each other and be at equal pay grades in partnership and cross-training with each other. So that's the vision for that piece. The last piece that's being recommended is a position called an employment specialist. Really, that position is being designated due to a void that exists in the human resources side of our operation. Currently, we have people who are responsible for keeping accurate records in human resources. We have people who are responsible for deploying substitutes, keeping the data accurate. But we really have no specific individual in our department who's responsible for recruitment and management of the application system that we have. We've hired approximately 200 employees since last July, and we really don't have a point person managing recruitment efforts to find great talent for the school district. We also were under a desegregation order, and we've not been able to do the work with the existing personnel that's necessary to really be doing affirmative recruitment that we need to do, especially in the instructional realm, in order to recruit diverse candidates. And so what we're proposing is a new position. It would be at the CWA 9 level. We've had a conversation with the union about that, and they agree to the salary level for the proposed position. They've reviewed the recommended job description. And the cost with the other position changes that we're recommending, the net cost increase is actually about $26,000 in total. So we're eliminating one position, we're remapping one position into the ProfTech world, we're establishing a ProfTech position, and then we're also creating this new position in the CWA ranks. And I want to clarify something that I wrote in the memo, because one board member asked me about it, and the position is not to recruit CWA employees. It's just a position that's represented by the CWA unit, because it's not something that needs to be segmented from the union. In fact, it's something that's appropriate within that union. The last piece I wanted to mention, aside from that, is we are recommending that the safety technician position be changed in structure out of the Human Resources Risk Management Department, but working primarily with Pete Copeman in the Building and Code Compliance Department. Most of the work that's done there relates to our buildings and facilities, either inspections of them or renovation of them or planning safety around those facilities. That position is responsible for inspections, fire inspections, things like that. And we were finding that there was a lot of replication of work between Pete in his previous position and Deb Wethington, who's the person who left that position. I'm sorry, I mentioned a name. The previous safety technician. There was a lot of overlap of job responsibility there. And so in allowing those two to work side by side in the same office together, we think that it will create a more efficient structure for the operation. And Pete's here today if you have questions. I can mention his name because he's here, right?
Yes. But you understand, we deal with what the recommendation is for the job descriptions.
Yes.
We deal with all of that. The recommendation for people to fill or not fill those positions is up to the superintendent.
Of course.
And we have to have some reason not to approve those. So that's not really within our purview when it comes to dealing with the personalities of the people involved.
Yes.
Sometimes we'd like for it to be, but it's not.
Yeah. And I assure you these recommendations are not because of the personalities. They're because the structure is something.
I'm not expecting to be, so.
Yeah, that will make us more effective and more efficient.
It would not be recommended approval tonight on the agenda by the superintendent.
And I appreciate the insights that Mr. Fritz has brought to the position. And I think in terms of efficiency of the work that's going to be done, and just to give you a kind of an advanced look at, you know, what the thinking is behind the job descriptions that we're asking you to approve tonight.
And we do appreciate that. We haven't had an opportunity to have a workshop on any of this, so
right.
This was the right time at the discussion session. So, board members, any questions? No direction, but certainly, yes, Ms. Disney.
As you add change and move positions, are these the placements given yearly contracts, or are they hired?
So it depends on the type of position. ProfTech positions are all annual contracts. CWA, after some time, they become ongoing obligations. So there's only one position in these that really becomes an ongoing obligation, and that is the employment specialist position. And it doesn't become ongoing until they've been successful for a period of time.
Do you anticipate needing as much support as you have over there, the support personnel, to support these other positions, or do they take on some of those duties?
So currently we have a administrative assistant in the department who's working with the manager and the benefits specialist who's currently there. And so really this the same person would be supporting two people just like she is now. It would just be a different set of people that she would be supporting. And then the employment specialist is a support position by its nature, actually would be providing some support for the position control person, who actually is doing a lot of time managing clerical tasks right now and really shouldn't be based on his job description.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Ms. Simmons.
Yes, I'd like to make a request, if board members are amenable for a future meeting, maybe at our next discussion session. In the past, when we talked about the org chart and all of the different intricacies of who's under who and who works with whom, we usually get the administrative chart, which is what we'll be seeing for approval. But we've also gotten the org chart for the different departments, so we can get a picture collectively of what this looks like, because one of our concerns has always been the amount of administrative staff that we've had, and in the past we've made cuts that have in the long run been detrimental to the organization, because we make the cuts and then we keep giving other people those roles so we can save money, but we are overburdening some of the staff. And it seems like what we're doing now is we're backtracking and we're being specific, we're being more efficient, and I truly do appreciate that. Number one, it would be helpful to see what that looks like. And then my only concern is, and I mentioned this to Dr. Adams when I met with her, is creating this position to be the point person for recruitment. You said we looked at 200 new employees since July, and I guess the question from the perspective of taxpayers does that give us a mandate, if you will, to increase that investment? You wouldn't be putting it forth if you didn't feel that that is what the district needed.
So I'm trying to hear the question in that.
So the question is, who's been doing this all this time, and why do we need a new position all of a sudden?
So it's been done partially by the position control specialist, who's a prof tech in our department. And really it is taking away work that he should be spending on other things, like working in cooperation with the budget department, working in cooperation with payroll on things. There are a number of items that actually have needed to wait till the last minute because he's been so busy dealing with running the application system that he can't give accurate information to payroll or to the budget department. And I'm not criticizing his skill. There's just too much on this person's plate. And so I think that's been a challenge. And really, in times when the economy was not as good as it is now, it's not great, but it's getting better, we weren't hiring that many people. In fact, unfortunately, we were reducing personnel. That's changed. We're in a place where some people who had been delaying retirement are finally making that decision because they can afford to now. The economy's a little bit better. We also are just seeing an increase in turnover of our employees with the right of the district to issue annual contracts, for example. So with an annual contract, you have the possibility of more people coming in the door on an annual level rather than the same people recurring. And so I think the workload has increased for a variety of reasons. I think that we've not been as efficient. The Human Resources Department, I obviously wasn't here at the time, was reduced in personnel pretty significantly, as I understand it. And so this isn't a full replenishment of the personnel that were let go before, but it will, at a fairly low cost, help us to resurrect some of those things that we need. The other piece that, and maybe this is just my belief, but it's sort of philosophy in leading human resources, even in bad times, we need to recruit the best. Right? And I think sometimes if we have a person who walks in the door and they've got a credential, we're willing to hire them. And I like to hold the bar a little higher, a lot higher than that. I want to find the best possible personnel to work with each of our children. And you don't just do that by posting your stuff on a website. You need to be a little bit more assertive, a little bit more aggressive. You need to have a relationship with each of the universities in the area. You need to be out there identifying talent internally that might be, for example, a support staff person who might become a good teacher for us, and trying to do that encouragement. But I always feel like we need to be trying to recruit the very best, and we've frankly not been able to do that because of our kind of limited personnel in the office. We've just been trying to stay above water. We've not been able to swim, and we really need to do more than just function and see who walks in the door. We need to be out there looking for the very best. And I believe that with regards to substitute teachers, too. Our substitute pool is still lean. I want to be recruiting great teachers to be substitutes within our school district so that when a teacher is out on the leave that they're entitled to, we can put a good quality person in there to replace them. So I think all of those things lead me to believe this is an important function that's been neglected, and also something that will help alleviate some of the work, but able to shift some of the work to other important priorities like keeping track of the budget and like making sure that we're accurate in our information and record keeping. The other thing that's upcoming that I didn't speak to in my memo is we're going to, because terms is sort of getting behind us, we're going to be changing our information processing system. I've been through that process in actually three previous school districts now, and what you find is even though technology is supposed to make your work easier, sometimes because of the way those systems work, it actually necessitates not more people, but increased communication amongst your people. So in those changes that we've seen before, you actually needed to have much closer communication between payroll, human resources, and the budget office, because the information is integrated in the system, and you've got to be able to have the people to focus on that interrelationship in each of those three different segments. And so this will enable that for the future.
Additional questions? Ms. Deason?
I was probably too long-winded. I apologize.
Well, Mr. Fritz, I can't say this is unexpected. I fully expected after you had some time to get to know your department and the district that there would be changes coming. And I truly believe that your department sets the bar for all of our employees from the first day that they come in and the way they're greeted and the process of hiring is a good indicator to the employee of the expectations that we want to see. I also am hopeful that by changing the manner in which things are done, we do see a reduction in the risk side of the finances. So I will support these positions. I do look forward to a report back as we go mm-hmm. forward that these changes are making, having the effect that you anticipate. Thank you.
Any additional questions?
Thank you, Lord.
I did want to mention two other elements in case you missed them, if that's okay.
Sure.
One,
it's Dr. Adams' time. She has a
talk. Okay. Yeah. So you'll notice there are two other slight changes. The director of physical plant has a change in theirs because one of the safety things is moving to him. It's just one line, but yeah. Wanted to mention that. And then the code compliance person, his job description changes slightly as a result of that. So I just wanted to make mention that those are on there as well. Not significant changes, but enough that where I wanted to make mention.
They are antique terms.
Yes, aren't they? Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank Appreciate you. It.
Okay, Dr. Adams, you have two more.
I do. I'd like to invite Mr. Morrison to the table, and I don't know whether you want Mr. Chuma. We wanted to talk again about tonight, another board item. Board members, as you know, there was some question, about the contract. So we want you to have all the information that we have, and so I've asked them to come and give.
Okay.
Full disclosure on where we are with that.
Good afternoon. We're discussing the notice that we received.
Yes.
The good news is that notice has been retracted, so there's nothing pending at this point in time. So everything we're discussing right now is more or less just informational purposes because the process has worked itself through and
right.
has since been resolved. Let's see, where do I start?
the process worked that we have, but we had to go through some discussion and rationale. So I think you just
I'll just do a quick review of the process itself. The way it works is if we post a recommendation, the vendors have an opportunity to, within 72 hours, to file a notice to protest. And then they have, after that, 10 days to, and I'm sure you can correct me if I make any mistakes in this, but they have 10 days in which to file their protest bond and their legal reasons for actually protesting the process. As soon as we receive that, then another clock starts in which we have 7 days to meet with that particular firm and resolve it. This was a little different in the fact that the vendor did file timely the notice. We did not receive a formal letter. In the notice, we received a request for the individual to review the scoring sheets that you have in front of you, as well as the DVD, because we record the presentation. And after review of the presentation, the vendor indicated that they felt that the person that's being ultimately recommended to you today was in fact the best presentation, and the vendor performed the best. So, and not only did we hear it from that, we also heard it from another particular company, which was Proctor Construction. Proctor Construction had also asked for a copy of the DVD. Donald Proctor had actually his entire staff view that as a learning tool. And we met with him on, I think it was August 3rd or 4th.
April.
And he also indicated the same thing, that he, after reviewing the process, that he agreed with the recommendation that's being put forth tonight. But the gist of the, which Summit Construction and it's Brad Shue, Mr. Brad Shue, had indicated that he had some concerns. And so in meeting, because after withdrawing his letter, we felt comfortable meeting with him to discuss any aspects. That's basically the way the process works as well, is we have an open door policy. We've kept an arm's length but professional arrangement with all our vendors, and I feel very comfortable in the fact that, you know, meeting with them to discuss any concerns that they may have at any time. And this just happened to be one of those opportunities, regardless of the protest or not, since that was resolved. He had two concerns, basically. One was the amount of questions that were asked during the presentation. And granted, we did have a few extra questions, more than we normally do. And the reason why is this was not a school. Being in an administrative complex, we wanted to extract some additional information on their expertise regarding, say, working with boardrooms, sound systems, things of that nature, and the whole vetting process and how they would work with staff. So we wanted that to come out in the process itself, so the selection team, the evaluation team, would have an opportunity to take that into consideration in the appropriate area on the point structure. That's an easy fix. You know, we'll certainly look at the questions in the future. What I will say, though, is that a few vendors in their presentations did get off track, and as a result, they ran out of time to a certain extent. They were able to complete their process, but they rushed through it at the very end. The vendors that actually were well-rehearsed were able to handle all the questions, because we do furnish the questions 1 week in advance of the process. The questions themselves were, over the years, we have determined that it's a way of basically keeping the process where the individuals in the, because it's 6 hours in this particular case, normally it's like four, but it keeps them engaged. You have that interaction, whether it's just a matter of paying attention where you are in the process, and then the give and take that takes place. And then it also allows us to, an opportunity to see how the vendors react to the individuals asking the questions and things of that nature. That's just the overall process itself. But the other concern that Mr. Shue had, which is another adjustment that that I'm going to recommend and probably implement in the next process, was the, now granted this is the same process that we've used for many, many years, is that we have allowed companies the courteous as a courtesy, the individuals who travel the greatest distance to the interview process a choice of scheduling them later in the process. So instead of being there at 8 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock, 12, whatever it may be, we have one continuous process. And it hasn't adversely affected any presentations we've done in the past because it's been consistent with our that method all along. So a local company, say, could be first, could be third, you know, could be even last, depending on how we schedule, but typically they would be earlier in the process. We're selected based on their, well, they presented and the information that they provided. But it was, the concern that was voiced to me was that in a process that lasts that long, a lot of times individuals listen to or the last presentation, and it may in fact give them an unfair advantage. So I give that some consideration, and obviously it hasn't been the case in the past. But what I like to do is I always like to have some type of logic built into the actual process itself. So what I indicated to both Mr. Bradshaw and Mr. Donald Proctor is that what we will do in as you see, you have 2 point totals there. One is the initial, and then one is the evaluation. In the initial, the process is used to basically create the short list. In this particular case, we decided to interview all six firms. One because of the point being relatively close, except for from 5 to 6. There's like a half point difference. So being that the points did not carry forward, we deemed it would be in the best interest of the district to interview and give everybody face time, since of the importance of this particular selection. But what I'm going to do in the future is that point total you see in front of you, whoever scored the greatest amount of points will be called first, and that individual will have the opportunity, if they like to go first, second, third, fourth, whatever it may be, will extend that opportunity to them. So this way they're rewarded for their paper presentation, and it will allow them to have an opportunity as far as determining where they'd be in the interview process. So those are the two concerns that we discussed, and both vendors felt that those were fair and equitable recommendations.
Board member questions? Again, we're not going to give direction as to how we're going to be voting or whatever.
Yes, I had some questions, and I think the direction in general, not in this specific instant, but in the future, I would not with the names of the evaluation team and not with individual totaled points, but I would like to see in the backup under if there are six possible vendors, I would just like to see the overall point chart. And the second, in some of my questions with staff, I feel, and it's not a board policy, but I feel as for a district safety, I feel that our threshold for a protest of only $5,000 to hold up a process, if the protest went through, only posting $5,000 to hold up a project, I feel, and that's an internal thing for your decision as a standard operating procedure, but I think your $5,000 threshold is way too low to possibly hold up a large project of ours, whether it's this one or any other project. That's my thought.
And that would only require a change in our purchasing procedures manual. It would not be a board policy with respect to the threshold for the bid bond. So
is there something that's more typical? I don't know. So
that's the research we'll have to do just to come up with a recommended amount.
And I prefer, rather than just arbitrarily changing the policy, yes. I'd like to see something that's research-based and some data.
Correct.
Not just to change.
Right. I was going to say, if you check with the county, sometimes it's a percentage of the overall job, which makes it very costly for the protester. He will reconsider whether they have a leg to stand on than to post that type of money. That if through a special magistrate or something is decided that they have held up the project, that money reverts to the school district. So very, very important that protester
they consider. It's not it doesn't become frivolous of a loss of $5,000 to hold up a million, multi-million dollar projects. So that would be worth looking into.
I just have a clarification question. This information that you gave us has the totals for the initial evaluation. So this is for the paper presentation that you used to...
There are two sets that I passed around, so you should have two sets.
This is what the top set looks like.
No, I only got one.
Well, it's
stuffed
on its way around.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, stuffed on its way around.
I have
the same thing, so I stopped and so did Carol.
Yeah, okay. Oh, all right.
This gives us a different picture.
Absolutely. Yes, it does.
Yes, you'll have, you may now in front of you have two sets.
Here's the initial evaluation. And here's the interview.
Well, we don't know what we didn't have because we didn't know what we were supposed to have. So, but thank you.
Yes.
Additional questions?
No, that was.
Okay. Any other board questions? Ms. Dizzy?
No, thanks. So, while that is the basis of the protest was not about our local companies, I know that that's still an issue out there, of our local companies feeling as if there's some bias toward, not towards out-of-town companies, but not in favor of local companies. And so would you address what we've done over the last few years in order to help our local companies be more competitive in the bids, please?
Sure. First, to address the last part of the question, and then I'd like to discuss the local aspect as well. In the process itself, we have things, of one of the criteria is local knowledge and things of that nature, and also the emphasis in the presentation is on the use of local subs. All the vendors did speak to that. It is, you know, part in the process. And I believe that the firm, it was between 79% and 82% is the figure that they used.
82%.
And they were citing a current project that they have, which is at Fellsmere. So that, I believe, did resonate with the evaluation team. There are some items that are not even available here locally in Indian River, like structural steel and things of that nature. So that number, as was indicated to us, would be much higher. And also in that presentation, and I'm speaking to just what we're discussing here in front of you, is that firms have become relatively creative. You have Pirtle Hood partner with a local firm, which is Pinnacle Construction, who, and I'm not sure if it's a partnership of equal, but what you have is the local participation from that particular vendor who also feels very strongly regarding the local aspect of it. But on the local part, if I may, I have had vendors over the years come to me with concerns regarding the local aspect, which is can be contrary from what you've been hearing in the past. Local is a double-edged sword, if I may. A lot of vendors have indicated to me that if barriers were created, say, in Brevard or St. Lucie County, and they were prohibited from participating, they'd have to close their doors. There's just simply not enough revenue being generated in a district of this size, in Indian River, to support them, to the company, and their employees. So I guess we have to be sensitive to the fact that, well, first of all, the state views the state of Florida as being local in the process that we're using versus what some counties and cities can do, I believe, because our dollars are created from more than just one source. But what has been indicated to me was a concern of that happening, and the fact that they would either have to downsize if that was, you know, barriers were created. So, I mean, I just believe that we need to be sensitive to that because if you look at, like, all the large projects that we've had very few since the downturn in 08. So those companies, if they were not able to participate outside of Indian River, more than likely wouldn't even be here. And then the other part is the competition aspect of it. You know, the process is based on a fair and competitive process to allow vendors to compete. I think that a lot of things that we do in this country is based on that premise as well. And to do things that would probably move away from that would be a concern to me. I think the process does provide the district with the best individual for that particular process being selected ultimately to do the work. So I think the competitive aspect of it bodes well for the district in the ultimate selection of who can do the project based on the criteria that's set forth in that particular RFQ.
Additional questions? I have a couple of questions. One is, all six of those who put in a proposal were allowed to present, and you're talking about past practices and what what actually was put on the written proposal, so what the timeline was going to be, what questions they were to have their presentation first, and I will tell you that this didn't just come from Mr. Hsu. It came from all of our local folks. They were a little surprised that practice had changed. They didn't do their presentation first. They were what they asked to do the questions first.
Actually, that's incorrect. We have never deviated. Questions have always been first.
Okay. All right. I apologize. Yeah. I heard a lot, and that's what I heard.
Right. And we have obviously, I even went back to view all the tapes, but obviously, I'm aware of it.
That's something I'm interested in, Mr. Chair. Okay. Thank you very much. Generally, we do not have six. I know we're trying. The board wanted to move this along, and I do understand that. Did we have six finalists before any time in recent history that you know of?
Only with architects. Only with a short amount of time that we had. It was for the same administrative complex.
Okay.
Typically, the statute reads you'll have three or more. Our past practice has been four. And the reason why I've done that in the past is so that if one, for whatever reason, fails to meet and show up for that particular interview process, I always have complied and have had at least the minimum of three. So four, but with sometimes with point totals being very, very close. And if you look at those point totals, and it was my call, and I did discuss it with one other individual, but you had a half a point separating the fourth and fifth vendor.
Right.
And I didn't want it to be viewed as being arbitrary and capricious and just eliminating one out of six as opposed. So, I made the call to bring in all six. Being that the point totals do not carry forward, it gave everybody an opportunity and face time with the group. But I think that I'm going to revert back, and regardless if it's even a fraction of a point if difference, we're going to stick with the four whenever possible. But I'd still like to keep the open in the event that, based on the team,
Absolutely.
They'd like to have that fifth person to come in for whatever reason. But overall, consistently stick to the four.
And my comments to those who, community members, now I'm not speaking about anybody who bid on this job, in our community, those things travel really fast. But my comment was, it was the direction of the board to move this project along as quickly as possible. We want our people out of this sick building as quickly as possible. So that was our direction to the superintendent, and obviously her direction to you. I did not see, and I might have missed this one too, so I do apologize in advance, but Pirtle Pinnacle is who we gave the award to for Felsmere. It was Pirtle Pinnacle on all the documents. It was Pirtle Pinnacle on the recommendation. I don't know what the percentages were for that collaboration. I know it's not a partnership, but I don't know what the percentages were for that. And I agree with your statement about folks from out of town. We don't want to cubbyhole our people. We wouldn't want another school district to cubbyhole our people because they happen to be coming from Indian River County, because you're right, they'd have to close their doors. But can you tell me, how is the contract going to be written?
The contracting entity will be Pirtle
Construction.
It's Pirtle Construction.
Construction.
I believe the last time that we brought that forward for Felsmere, we had Pirtle/Pinnacle, which suggested that they were forming a limited liability partnership company, and I remember at the board, I think it was board member Pegler who raised the issue, and as a result of that, I believe voted against it. So we made sure this time around that we put the proper contracting entity on the agenda, but they will be the ones who sign on the dotted line.
And Pinnacle is not involved in this project?
Pinnacle is, yes.
Pinnacle is still involved.
Absolutely.
But as secondary.
Yes,
The contract itself, there's a separate agreement that probably resides below that level between those two firms. But the contracting agent in this particular case is Pirtle Construction.
Okay.
Well, I applaud staff. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize anybody else had a question. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I didn't realize I had a question either. So as a result of this partnership, because Hurdle Pinnacle has a local representative, did they get any additional points for having that local collaboration, if you will, even though the contracting agent is Hurdle?
I would have to obviously get with the review team. I don't know that off the top of my head. But I think that what they spoke to in their presentation was the subs, and that aspect of it, the 82%, is what resonated with the group, not the fact that the two of them were in the...
Okay, let me rephrase my question then. So when you look at your criteria sheet to evaluate these different companies, is there a section of the sheet that has specific points because... by virtue of being local.
Local knowledge.
Yes. Local knowledge. Actually, the criteria is right here.
So if that is the case, even though the out-of-town business is signing the contract, does that in any way, is that in any way a way of getting additional points for being from outside, but because you partnered with local, you're going to get an advantage in terms of your knowledge of local conditions. Do you see what I'm getting at?
And that would be up for the team's interpretation of how that's presented to them. Local knowledge does not mean just that if you reside within Indian River, you have the best local knowledge. It may be an upstart company with very limited knowledge. Here you have a company in this particular case who's currently very familiar because they're working and know the subs and in Indian River, so it's difficult for me to speak for the team. Again, it's based on their presentations and how they scored. And you see that you'll have individual scoring that may have resonated with some and not with others. So without me surveying them, I could honestly say.
Just because in the past there's been that conversation about local advantage, I just want to make sure that.
And I think if you look at our overall percentage, and I haven't done an analysis recently, but we have done one in the past, we were in the high 80s to 90% as far as in the selection process being local. And that was even with incorporating a few hard bids in there as well. So overall, I've been very, very proud of the fact that we've been able to accomplish that. But through an open practice, and open, it's undetermined prior to going into it who ultimately is going to be selected.
Additional board questions, Ms. Simchick.
Well, and I did have a question with local, but I don't have a problem with. I just want to tell my kids with local being regional. I mean, if you go and you check with other municipalities within Indian River County and even our surrounding borders, your local is considered regional, and just for some of the reasons that they mentioned. You also, which was an example, if you have local whose years in business is one or five, and you have the next county over and their years in business are 25, you know, there's all sorts of volleying for points. So that was a big word years ago when the economy got very tight, local, 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 but local is really somewhat regional, but obviously, and I don't know what we do for what we, how we even define local, but also other agencies would do. If you had a direct definition of local, then you could use if a tie goes to the local vendor, and that's just another issue. But as I said, defining local is very hard.
Additional board questions? Well, I'd like to thank very much the open door policy of our staff for having Mr. Proctor in and having Mr. Hsu in. Obviously, you did a good job because he has withdrawn his intention, so I really compliment you for that. It is a tough thing. My concerns, as I expressed to Dr. Adams, is this has been a contentious issue in the community. We don't need that little twittering going on out there. And hopefully tonight and some of the other comments, and especially the openness of our staff and the willingness to address some of those suggestions for next time around, I think are to be applauded. So I do thank you for that. I think that's very commendable. So, again,
need to get that triple down.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm also glad that we have that arm's length for this whole process.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This one's going to be fast.
Okay. It's going to be fast.
Okay. The last thing that I have is, if you remember, we talked about modifying the rule that we had, and it's called conflicting employment or contractual relationship. And it came forth when we had an employee of a school who was an officer within the company, and based on our current rule, we were unable to provide, award the bid to that company because they were doing business with the district. So what Mr. Grester brought forward is actually this went beyond statute, okay? And so what we agreed is that we would look at this board rule. And Suzanne, you want to just mention the wording that you put in? And so it opens it up, but still keeps us clear and
absolutely.
Legal.
The statute that we're dealing with is in the Code of Ethics for Public Officials and Employees. It's in Chapter 112. And on line 7 of the policy with the red lining that you have in front of you, line 7, your existing policy uses the word, if you are prohibited as an employee, in any category of employee, from doing business with the district. Okay, and when you look in the definition section of your board policy, the district is the school board of Indian River County. So all employees, according to these policies, are prohibited from doing any business with any department or division within the school district. In our prior discussion, basically the question was the information shared is this sentence, prohibited from doing business with the district, is a step beyond what Chapter 112 does. Chapter 112, the Code of Ethics for Public Officials, the wording in that statute is what you see in red, and that's underlined. You're prohibited from doing business with an agency of which you're an officer or an employee. And what the Commission on Ethics tells us, and I brought an example for you because I think examples are so important. What the Commission on Ethics tells us is it's the same thing, so you don't, it's the same document going two ways. What this opinion tells us from the Commission on Ethics is this language for a teacher or a school board employee, your agency, where you're employed, your agency is for a teacher at your school. So a great example for a teacher is a teacher cannot be under contract to do work for their own school. But a teacher, according to this, if you look at the third page, because the good stuff is always at the very end, the top paragraph that starts here, the subject instructor teaches, that what that paragraph tells us is a teacher, according to the Commission on Ethics, is allowed to be under contract to do work at a different school. It has nothing to do with their school, that has nothing to do with their work at their school. And this example from the Commission on Ethics back in the 70s is that a PE instructor wanted to be able to do landscaping work at a different school, and they put in a contract or a bid to be able to do that work. And the question was posed to the Commission on Ethics, is that allowable? Or does the Code of Ethics prohibit that teacher from doing that? And after many pages of analysis, because we can't say it with two words, we have to say it with three pages, after many pages, the Commission on Ethics came to the conclusion, and that's the paragraph that I've said on the third page, that's the good stuff. The Commission on Ethics said, yes, under these facts, it was a teacher at elementary school A. They put in a bid for work over here at elementary school B. They had nothing to do with the procurement. They have nothing to do with making the decision or making a recommendation. When they are completely separated from the process of decision, then the code of ethics does not prohibit them from putting in for that work and being awarded that contract, okay, if there's a separation, right? So with that as our example, if it were a different level of employee, it's probably going to be a different answer. I mean, let's be clear. If it's the director of facilities who wants to put in to do work as the custodian over, you know, that's going to be a problem because of that the oversight and the recommendation process, and they do have input into who gets the work. They have recommendation process. But if we're talking about someone not at a management level, a teacher or a custodian or a food service worker, according to the Commission on Ethics, as long as there's that separation, it's not a problem. Locally, you can decide that you will heighten that. You know, the Commission on Ethics is kind of the bar. Here's the bar that we all must meet. A school board can heighten it, but you can't lower it. And with your policy, what happened was, and I don't think we intended to do it, but what happened was with the use of the word the district, we heightened that ethical standard. And so what this language will do, if you wish to move forward with it, it will bring us back to the Commission on Ethics standard, that bar, so that we are not, if at your pleasure, we are not prohibiting people from doing business with the school district if it's not an otherwise ethical conflict of interest according to the Commission on Ethics. So that's what this language will do, and it kind of comes from a previous discussion this board had where you really wanted to be at the Commission on Ethics level. You weren't really intending to heighten that bar. But this language will get us there, and you have three of them because we have administrators, we have instructional, and we have support staff. So we have three different policies.
It looks the same in each one.
Land the plane.
Thank you.
So if you're okay with this, we would like, the next step would be to bring it forward to a public hearing. Right.
To get permission to advertise for a public
hearing. To get permission to advertise for a public hearing. And then we will have a public hearing.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank
Any
you
questions?
Very much.
All right.
Comments from the board? I'd like to move it forward. Thank you very much, Ms. Seacrest.
Thank you.
Welcome.
And we have an executive session.
And actually, we're going to conclude. Ms. Stang, I need you to turn off the tape. Meeting adjourned.